Anyone who changes into the lane in front of my car without indicating. Any piece of software which doesn't start up immediately when I press the button. Any telephone which shunts me into an answering system and no humans actually answer the phone. And so on and so forth. So often we fail to live up to that ideal, isn't it? And we find ourselves tested. There's a very lovely sutta we read some time ago in the sutta class called the Kakatyupama Sutta. And where the one of the stories it tells in there is with the maid, Kali, who was obviously quite a bit naughty. And so she had her boss, her employer had this reputation for being very kind and very gentle. And so the maid thought she would test. So she slept in, got up late. And then her boss said, "Well, hey, Kali, what are you doing? Get up late." She said, "Oh, I just felt like sleeping in." He said, "Oh, you naughty girl. You mustn't get up late." And so she kept on testing her. Got up later again. "Hey, Kali, what are you doing?" Eventually she got so annoyed, she whacked her over the head with a rolling pin. And Kali went down the street with blood pouring out of her head saying, "See, this is what that gentle lady's done. See, this is what that kind lady's done. This is what that lady who's supposed to be full of loving kindness, this is how she's acting." So this is a little kind of fable that the Buddha gave in one of his suttas. It's a very nice fable. I mean, one of the things I like about these things, they're very subversive. You know, it's sort of, the implication is that it's actually okay to test your supposed elders and betters and all of these kinds of things. I mean, she was in a very powerless situation. She was called Dasi, which usually means like a female slave. Although slavery in ancient India wasn't the same as it was in Europe, not that same idea of being a slave, but certainly she wasn't in a very powerful position and could have had some pretty bad consequences from that. But then she goes and just is naughty anyway, which I think is very nice. So, but that's a very realistic situation, isn't it? That when everything's going fine, nothing's challenging us, no one's pressing our buttons, then we're okay. And we imagine that we're very kind. But what happens when things get really bad? What happens when we get in a situation where we're tested? How far can we be tested before we're going to break? What is the human potential for being tested? How far can we actually be pushed before we're going to give way? When I'm saying this and giving this introduction, I have this very compelling story in the back of my mind, which I would like to share with you. As a monk, I'm very privileged to hear lots of people's life stories. And one of the things that you always learn is that people are really totally amazing. And that, you know, when you look at some people, they come and they say the most incredible things have happened to them in their lives, you know. Absolutely amazing. And as a monk, people feel safe. They feel like they can open up and tell you a story. So I hear many different kinds of things that people wouldn't say to other, you know, wouldn't say. And this is one story which I've heard at a certain time in my life as a monk. And I was told this story, and up until now I've never shared it, but for some reason I feel like sharing it with you tonight. But it's a very challenging story. It'd be interesting to see I'd be interested to know your feedback or how you respond to it. This is a story of a woman who was quite a serious, dedicated Dhamma practitioner for many years, had done many retreats and had a regular practice for a long time, maybe 10, 20 years or more. And one night she was attacked, and this man attacked her and started raping her. And she was obviously completely traumatized and horrified at while this was going on. And one of the most horrible experiences that one can possibly imagine. And as it went on, she started to try to kind of use the Dhamma to help her cope with the experience right as it was happening. And just saying, this is just physical, this is just a body, this is just two bodies, body parts intersecting in this kind of way, and there's no me, there's no mind. And started to get some kind of distance from this whole act as it was happening. And as this started to happen, and something opened up in her as this happened, something happened, which she couldn't explain or understand, but she had just had this incredible, was just overcome with these incredible waves of loving kindness. And this incredible strong metta, which just broke out of her heart and was just like these oceans of loving kindness spreading out over the whole universe. And this was while the rape was still going on. And she was just completely given up to these feelings of like just an ocean of loving kindness pouring out into the universe, and including her rapist, who was still raping her at that time. And she was just sitting there with this just incredible, she'd never felt any, she'd been meditating for maybe a decade or two decades and never experienced anything like this. And then after this happened for a little while, the man just kind of stopped and rolled off her and just started crying. And he just started crying and crying and just had his head on her chest. And just was crying like a baby, just tears flowing out of him again and again and more and more and more. And then when he could talk, he just, please forgive me, I'm so sorry, how could I have done this? And then just started confessing his whole life to her. He had been a serial rapist, he'd been in jail before, and had just got out of jail, was still on probation, and was begging her, please take me to the police, please turn me in. I can't stand the thought that I'm going to do this to anybody else anymore. And he was just so overcome, overwhelmed. Yep. And sure. Yeah. So often when people are doing loving kindness meditation, they ask me, when you do loving kindness, if you do it for a certain person, can they feel it? Can they receive it? Well, certainly it seems in some cases they can. So anyway, she got herself together and went back home, and walked into her house, and her housemate she was staying with said, oh, have you had a nice day? She said, I've just been raped. She said, well, you don't look like you've just been raped. He said, no, I don't feel like it either, I feel fine. And she wasn't traumatized at all by the experience, she just felt perfectly okay. And she felt so deeply in her heart, she felt so deeply that fellow had completely changed. The experience was so profound for her, and she felt it was so profound for him as well, that she didn't tell the police. And she felt that he would never do that again. And She didn't suffer from any trauma or anything after that. It was quite okay. One of the interesting kind of codas or something to that experience was that the reason why she told me this was because she had spoken about this with a couple of spiritual teachers beforehand and had been quite confused by their answers. One of them had told her that she was just in denial, that this whole experience was just an experience of denial, that she had repressed childhood memories and all these kinds of things and was just trying to repress the trauma. And so she was very confused, interestingly enough. She wasn't at all traumatized by being raped, but she was very traumatized by having people who she trusted as spiritual teachers giving her these kinds of advice. Yeah, and this happened to her a couple of times by people who are quite well-known teachers, people whose names you'd probably recognize if I said them now, who are quite well-known teachers in the Buddhist world. And so then she asked me, what was going on or what happened? I said, you know what happened. You don't have to ask me what's happened. You just told me what's happened. You know, she was still looking for, in a sense, looking for somebody else to validate her experience, to give it that stamp of authenticity or to tell her what it was. And so I just had to try to turn that back on her and say, you know, this is your experience. You know what was going on. You're the one who has to understand that. I can't understand it for you. So that certainly sort of raises the bar a bit, doesn't it? In terms of learning how to let go, in terms of the excuses that we like to make for getting angry, in terms of how we can very easily become a victim, very easily become in our mind a victim of circumstances. And you could see that in that situation, even though physically she was totally powerless and totally violated, but spiritually she came out of that as a hero, not just as a victor in a short term, but as someone who had accomplished something which was very, very powerful both for herself and for the other person, and which left a very, very long-term powerful stamp on her mind. And may have sort of very seriously changed that person's life. So I don't know myself whether that was the right thing to do, to whether she should have told the police and dobbed him in, or whether she was right to not do that. I can't say what was the right choice there. But for me, the really incredible thing was how she, you know, doing things which, you know, was not necessarily you know, she wasn't like a, you know, even though she was a long-term practitioner, she wasn't a kind of a meditation master or anything like that. She wasn't a kind of enlightened, you know, guru or anything like that. You know, she was a struggling practitioner who had many difficulties along the way. And so somehow all of that came to help her in that time. And that's what we really need, isn't it? Yeah. All of those sits when we're coming along when we feel that we really can't sit meditation, we can't meditate because I'm too tired, I can't meditate because I'm too busy, I can't meditate because I've had too many distractions and tensions during the day, I can't meditate because it's too hot, I can't meditate because it's too cold, I can't meditate because it's too noisy. All of those kinds of excuses, none of which mean anything, of course. So each time we want to meditate, in a sense, we have to overcome these voices. Because, of course, it's never perfect to meditate. It's never perfectly quiet. It's never like a perfect temperature. Our body never feels perfect. We can do yoga and all of these things for years, and still we'll have some pain and discomfort in meditation. Again, as a meditation teacher, very frequently many people who come along to meditation have been doing yoga for a long time or are yoga teachers, and still, you know, even though they're very, very flexible and very fit and very adept and so on, they'll still have pains in their body. They have to overcome this in meditation. So there's always this difficulty. There's always something to overcome. Each time we sit meditation, we're creating that bit more determination. We're creating that bit more strength in our mind, and we're making it more possible for that Dhamma to come to us when we really need it, because we never know when that moment's going to come. When I was in Perth, I heard another story of this Thai lady who was in a car crash, driving along in the car, sitting in the back seat. She saw they're going through an intersection. The other car went through the red light. She saw the two cars coming together. She knew there was going to be a very, very bad accident. They were going too fast, and it was a very bad accident. And just when the cars were about to hit, her mind just went into meditation. She just recollected Buddha was a meditation object that just came into her mind automatically. And then she just went into that state and knew nothing of the accident, just went into a meditation. The accident happened. She came out very soon afterwards. A couple of people were dead. Others were very badly injured. It was an extremely bad accident. She was perfectly okay. Just came out of the meditation. And she was all right. You know, nothing. This kind of thing is happening all the time. It's happening all the time. It's not some kind of esoteric myth. It's not kind of some story or legend from long ago and far away. It's not something that only happens to Jedi Knights and things like that, you know. Happens to ordinary people. You know? Ordinary everyday people like the people sitting here. Not just monks and nuns who experience these kinds of things. And so when we want to practice, do spiritual practice, you know, in a sense we're looking for, you know, often we have a feeling we want to, you know, we want awakening, don't we? We want enlightenment, yeah? We want to wake up. And we want some kind of spiritual experience, some kind of authentic spiritual experience, some kind of deep spiritual experience. This is something that we feel that we're lacking. And it's very true and very sad thing that I think all of the great religions are built on very profound spiritual experiences. If we look at the life of Jesus, for example, we see these very profound experiences that he seems to have had. It's difficult to work out exactly what it was. The same with Muhammad, that he had these staying in the cave, doing contemplation and prayer. And this is where the voice of God first descended on him, and he's had these visions and so on. And in some sense had a very profound experience, which obviously changed him and changed the world. The same thing in the Brahmanical scriptures and so on and so forth. And we see this sense of something, some kind of insight, some kind of awakening, some kind of illumination, whatever it may be. And of course, for Buddhism, this being absolutely central, you know, that thing of awakening. And it happens at a moment. It happens at a time. Not necessarily a moment in the technical sense of like that kind of moment, but it happens at a particular point in time, there's a particular event. And it talks about this in the Vinaya, the discipline for the bhikkhus and bhikkhunis, that if somebody claims to be enlightened at any one of the stages of enlightenment, then if you want to find out whether they're right or not, one of the ways you test that is you ask them, when did that happen? What time was the experience? Yeah? And if it was a real experience of awakening, they should be able to tell you that it happened such and such a time on such and such a date. They should be very clear. If they're not clear about when the experience happened, then it's not the real thing. It's something which happens at such a profound level that it leaves a very, very deep imprint on your mind. That's something also that you know, you maybe have experienced in your meditation. Certainly I can remember, like, you know, certain times, certain events in my life and in my meditation where, you know, I've experienced very deep states in meditation or certain insights and so on. And I can remember them very clearly, even many, many years ago. They make a very deep imprint on my consciousness. So, for example, I can remember as I'm sitting here when I did my first retreat after about 12 days or something, 10 or 12 days on my retreat, and just standing outside the room where I did my retreat and looking at the trees. And just for the first time ever in my life, realizing that this is what clarity of mind is. Now I can see this clearly. The windscreen in my mind has just been polished and cleaned for the first time. Oh, that's what it means. This is what it means to actually feel peace of mind and clarity, to be able to know well. And that's something which I'd never known before. And that happened at a specific time during my first retreat. I can remember, for example, another thing I can remember is the first time when I ever experienced joy while watching my breath. Because when I tried to do breath meditation, like many people, you try to watch the breath, it's very dry. It's just kind of air coming in and out. And, you know, it was a bit boring, really. It's just air coming in and out. You know, it's just what's there to get excited about. And in those days, well, my first few years at Bodh Nanachart, I was a monk in the early 90s. The teachings of Ajahn Brahm were not so well known. He was just getting started, really, as a teacher. And so all of the very skillful means which he uses to create these perceptions of beauty and happiness and bliss together with the breath, these are things which weren't really well known in our community at that time. And so I was kind of stumbling along, and then there was, I remember this one time, sitting meditation. I was sitting just next to a creek in Dowdham near Kanchanaburi when I was Anagarika before I ordained as a monk, and just kind of sitting there and then just feeling this perception of this very, very soft joy and rapture coming through the breath, actually feeling it, experiencing it in the breath, you know. And just, wow, it's amazing, you know. I never thought I could do that or have that kind of perception, that kind of experience. So those things leave an imprint on your consciousness. And when we come to Buddhism, you know, one of the things that we want is this kind of experience. We want to feel, what's this spiritual bliss? What's this awakening? How do we bring this awakening about? And of course, it's not something we can program. It's not something we can sort of turn on at will and just say, you know, we're just going to do it. So a lot of the practices that we do in Buddhism are things which are almost like holding practices. They're things which are keeping us there. They're keeping us contained. We're keeping us in that area or in that zone where those things can happen, where they're more likely to happen, and where, more importantly, we can make use of them when they do happen. Okay, because when I say make use of them, I mean we can understand them. Yeah, we have a context when we can understand them. Okay, so again, these kinds of things happen all the time and they happen to everybody. So, you know, many times people have, you know, maybe have an experience where they may be walking in nature and, you know, just going for a walk through a park and then maybe feeling an experience of bliss or rapture or something. Like, for example, the Bodhisattva, the young Siddhartha Gautama did when he was a child. And his father was off working, and he sat under the rose apple tree in the hot day. He sat under the shade of the rose apple tree, and then just spontaneously, as he sat there watching his breath come in and out, and went into first jhana. And so his mind went into a very, very deep state of bliss and concentration and samadhi. Entirely naturally, he didn't have a teacher, he didn't have a dogma, he didn't have a method, he didn't have a doctrine. That was just the way of nature. Yeah? Just that's what happened. And so these things probably happen quite often, I think. I think probably children are doing this kind of thing fairly regularly. But we don't notice it. Yeah? Maybe adults are doing them fairly regularly as well, people around us. A lot of people have very extraordinary experiences. And but unless we have some kind of context to sublimate that, to understand it, to understand the causes and conditions and to be able to repeat it, then it's not necessarily all that useful just by itself. So, I think if we look at the spiritual realm today and different kinds of religious activity and so on that's going on, I know for myself, brought up from a traditional Catholic background, and it seems to me that a lot of the Catholic ritual and so on was originally steeped in and designed to evoke some kind of emotional and spiritual response. So, you know, the whole sort of thing, you go into a church or a cathedral and the space and the light and the hymns or the mass and the incense and everything, and it's evoking some kind of emotional response. But I think that's more or less gone. I think in most cases, certainly in my experience, that's not there anymore. And so it's become very dry and very, very cold. And then in a lot of the evangelical churches are trying to sort of revive that. So you see the Hillsong and all of these kinds of things. They're trying to liven it up and bring some kind of experience, some kind of feeling back into these things. And also like speaking in tongues and all of these kinds of things where you actually have some kind of spiritual experience. But from a Buddhist perspective, these things are quite genuine spiritual experiences, but happening at quite a low level, not at a particularly refined level of consciousness. So when we try to meditate, we want to bring these things about at a more refined level, a more useful, more subtle level. And one of the characteristics of that is it's repeatable, so that when you come to meditate, you can do it more often, not just that one special occasion. Yeah? But can you do it to make it actually work? So to make it work each time you meditate, you have to understand cause and effect. You actually have to understand how does the mind working. And the key to that is understanding what is that the quality of application that I'm bringing to meditation. This is really the key. It's not like what meditation technique do you do. See, a lot of people come to me and they say, oh, I'm doing XYZ meditation technique and it doesn't work for me. I'll try another one. So yeah, you can do that and you can try another one. But really, what makes it work is what is the quality of application that you bring? Neither too pushing nor too relaxed. A sense of evenness. Not too elated, not too depressed. A sense of constancy on the meditation object, keeping on going, keeping on, evenness. And that very deep sense of patience, that says, whatever happens, absolutely whatever happens, I'm not going to change or give up. This is my path, right here, right now. This meditation, this practice, this emotion, this feeling, these words, this is my life. This is my path. This is my reality, right here and now. And I don't care if I'm going to die. I don't care if a meteor drops through the roof and smashes me on the head. I don't care if a lightning strike is going to come and hit me. Okay? which incidentally in America, you're more likely to be hit by a lightning strike than you are to die of terrorist attack in America. So. So even if you're going to be hit by a lightning strike, I'm not going to do anything. That's the kind of application that you need. And so this is why at the end of every time we do the guided meditation, I always ask you to reflect, because that's what I want you to look at. I want you to step back from it a little bit and reflect back on it. You need that distance so you're not always in it. Step back and you say, what was going on? And you look, and then you can see what actually is that quality, the quality of application, the quality of awareness. And then that's what will bring results, that is what will make meditation come together. So this is one of the things that makes meditation really useful, or spiritual experiences really useful, is to make them repeatable. This is why we have a method to do that. And also to have a context within which to understand it. And this also is very, very important. You know, like that example, the story I just told. You know, it's interesting that there's different contexts within which one could understand that. You know, for example, from a Buddhist context, that kind of experience is not really problematic from Buddhism. Okay? Somebody's under a situation of extreme pressure, they're able to let go, and then from that experience, loving kindness for the person who they should hate. So from a Buddhist perspective, that's a perspective of transcendence. Now from a psychological perspective, it's almost assumed that you can't actually do that. It's almost assumed that that's not within like the normal sort of spectrum of human response to that kind of situation. So there must be something wrong. And it's always kind of looking for something. Well, there must be something repressed from the childhood and blah, blah, blah. And of course, if you want to look at people's childhood, you always find something repressed in there. Yeah, if you make that assumption, then that's another way of looking for it. And so depending on what context you want, what theoretical context you interpret it through, will turn that situation, that experience, which is just itself, the experience is just the experience. It doesn't have a context, just like the Buddha or the Bodhisattva sitting under the rose apple tree didn't have a context. He wasn't practicing Buddhism, right? He wasn't practicing anything, he was just sitting under a tree. And so because of that, he wasn't able at that time to do anything with it. Okay? It just happened, and then he forgot about it. And it wasn't until many, many years later he was able to recall it and say, oh, okay, that's what it was. And then it had a context. Oh, maybe that could be the path to enlightenment. He knew what he wanted now. He knew where he was going. He knew what the goal was and wondered, okay, is this the way to that goal? Is this the path to that goal? And so if we have that framework and that context, that will give meaning to the experience. But it's very important when we're thinking about this is that the experience is not created by that context that we bring to it. Okay, it's very important that the context is there to enable or to make the experience meaningful. We need context to make things meaningful, but we're not trying to explain away or change that experience by giving it some kind of interpretation. Okay, and this is one of the problems that happened in that story. Again, that lady had an experience which could be taken on a face level as representing like a kind of a spiritually heroic act or moment, a moment of like intense awakening. And yet because there was a theoretical model applied to that which wanted to see it in a certain way, then that became something which was very problematic for her for many years. So this is something always to remember, that when we're meditating, when we're practicing, we're looking for that experience. We want to have, you know, an experience, a genuine experience of awakening, of letting go, of getting in touch with that loving kindness. We want to feel that, we want to experience that, and Buddhist practices are designed to bring that about and to hold that in a useful way. But when those experiences happen, don't be in a hurry to try to interpret it and explain it too much. Accept it for what it is. Yeah? Use that for furthering your way to awakening, but don't get too involved in trying to interpret and understand it. There's my little talk for you this evening, and I hope you found that interesting.